Support for this podcast and the following message come from the United States Postal Service. Turn shipping to your advantage with USPS Ground Advantage service. Learn how to gain a competitive edge at usps.com/advantage. USPS Ground Advantage. Simple, affordable, reliable.
This is Chasing the Eclipse, a special production from The Pulse. 30 years ago, in 1994, science writer David Baron got some advice that changed his life. He was reporting on an upcoming partial solar eclipse. That's when the moon passes between the Earth and the sun and casts its shadow on the Earth. David was interviewing the late astronomer Jay Pasikoff,
who basically went to every solar eclipse that occurred anywhere in the world. He probably saw more eclipses than anybody ever in human history.
Pasikoff explained how the partial eclipse they were about to experience was different from a total solar eclipse.
Which, in the course of a total eclipse, the moon completely blocks the face of the sun, and it creates what he described as the most awe-inspiring spectacle in all of nature. He said, you know, before you die, you owe it to yourself to experience a total solar eclipse.
David took his advice, and in February of 1998, he traveled to Aruba to witness his first total solar eclipse on the beach.
It was like I left the Earth and was seeing the solar system from another planet. It was this transcendent experience. As soon as the last rays of the sun were blocked off by the moon, the moment the total eclipse began, I looked up in the sky, and it was just the most glorious sight I'd ever seen.
Now, this is the only time when the sun is fully covered by the moon that it's safe to look at the sun with the naked eye.
You know, the thing about a total eclipse, you think of it as that during eclipse something is hidden. But actually, the thing about a total eclipse is what is revealed. It's that during a total eclipse, the blue sky gets stripped away, and you can actually look with the naked eye at the center of the solar system. You can see the sun, not the surface, but the sun's atmosphere, the solar corona, which is just the most beautiful sight in the heavens. It's this beautifully textured thing in space, sort of like a wreath that's been woven out of silk. You see these strands coming off. What you're seeing are the magnetic field lines of the sun as the solar wind, this stream of particles, charged particles, comes off the sun. You can see the sun and the planets at the same time. And I felt like I had left the Earth and was looking back, and it was like looking at a diagram from a high school science textbook. There's the solar system.
It's rare to be able to witness a total solar eclipse, but part of the country is about to experience this big event on April 8th, when a narrow path of totality will stretch from Texas to Maine. On this episode, we'll find out why so many people say these events are life-changing, and why scientists are ready to pounce on this brief moment with high-tech instruments and weather balloons. We'll also pay tribute to the celestial body that makes this spectacle of nature possible, the moon. To get started, let's hear more from science writer David Baron. Now, the whole event that you witnessed in Aruba on the beach, it doesn't last very long, but did it feel short or long?
Both and neither, because it's like it's an out-of-body experience. I felt like I had entered some weird other dimension where time didn't have any relevance anymore. And so it both felt like it lasted forever and it felt like it was over in an instant. But total eclipses are always short events. The longest, the very longest, will be maybe a little over 7 minutes. Most of them are less than 3 minutes. Last April, I went all the way to the far end of Australia for a total eclipse that lasted 56 seconds. But it was an amazing 56 seconds.
To go back to your first total eclipse, did you decide in that moment, oh, I'm going to do this again?
Absolutely. I mean, as soon as it was over, it was like a sense I wanted to go back to that place. Like I just spent 3 minutes in some fantasy land, and then I'd been ripped back to reality at the end of the total eclipse when the sun came back out, and I want to go visit that place again. And that place is standing in the shadow of the moon. And I know this sounds like an eccentric passion. There are a lot of people like me. When I was in Aruba in 1998, I was meeting these crazy eclipse chasers who'd seen 6, 12, 20 total eclipses. And before the eclipse, I was thinking, what? These people will go all around the world for this brief event. And as soon as it was over, I knew I was going to become an eclipse chaser myself.
And what do you think the it factor is here that we as humans seek? Is it about connection, our place in the universe, understanding some aspect of human existence that we get closer to in that moment?
I think it's all three. Boy, there's a lot of research that's been done in recent years into the phenomenon of awe. What is it about the experience of awe that affects our brains? And feeling awe, being in the presence of something truly magnificent and powerful and so enormous that your mind can't wrap itself around it, is, it turns out, is a really powerful and meaningful experience in life, which for the most part we get from things like religion. That, you know, to feel yourself in the presence of God, if you believe in God, you can feel both infinitely small, just a tiny speck of no significance, but at the same time, you feel connected to something all-powerful. And that is the experience I have at a total eclipse, is it reminds me that I am nothing. I am on this tiny, meaningless planet around this enormous sun that's part of a universe that's so much bigger than we can possibly comprehend. But at the same time, I realize I am part of that universe, that, you know, I may be tiny, my life might not last that long, but I'm part of something so enormous and magnificent that it's actually, it gives me a great sense of peace. And getting back to that phenomenon of awe, what researchers have talked about is how when you feel awe, when you feel humbled and tiny, it dissolves the ego. You actually feel yourself connected with everything else, with other people. And there's a phenomenon of being in an eclipse. You feel incredibly bonded with the people you are with in that experience. And I would encourage on April 8th, first of all, that everyone who can go to the path of totality, get into that zone where it's going to be a total eclipse, because that's the only place you're going to have this full experience. And to go there with people you care about, because it really, it's something quite literally you will never forget, and you will always remember being there with the people that you care about.
It sounds like the first eclipse is one that just has stuck with you all these years. Have you seen others that have come close, or is each eclipse its own kind of grand event?
They're all memorable. They're all wonderful, but they're all different. And I would say in terms of the overall emotional impact, the first one was the one that really bowled me over because I didn't know what to expect. But they're all special and they're all different. So each total eclipse is different, first of all, because the sun is different. The sun's outer atmosphere, the solar corona, has a different shape each time, depending on what's going on the sun, where the sun is in its 11-year solar cycle of activity. And just, you know, there might be red, what look like red flames called prominences coming off. The shape of the corona itself, sometimes it looks like a sunflower. Sometimes it looks more lopsided, like it has lobes coming off on two or three directions. The planets are different each time. That first eclipse in Aruba, I had those three planets that were just very prominently visible. Other times, you may not see any planets. Seeing a total eclipse in a remote area, I was in a remote part of Indonesia for one eclipse. That was wonderful to sort of just be feeling like I was out in the middle of nowhere. On the other hand, seeing a total eclipse in the middle of a large city can be quite special. In 1999, I was in Munich and saw a total eclipse from the rooftop of a high-rise hotel. And that was an amazing experience, to be able to look out at the other rooftops and into the streets where people were just gathered everywhere, and where the entire city just rose up in one enormous cheer as the moon's shadow came in. So each one is different. They're all special. And that's why I just keep going back. Whenever I can, I will go see a total eclipse wherever it is in the world.
And encourage others to do the same.
Absolutely. And it is a fundamentally different experience to see a total eclipse versus a partial eclipse. Even a 99% partial eclipse is not one millionth as good as a total eclipse. And I am not exaggerating. It's sort of like, I mean, to see a 99% partial eclipse is like driving 99% of the way to see a Taylor Swift concert, but you never go in. You turn around and go home. It's only at the 100%, only when it's total, when that last little bit of the sun is covered, that you enter this completely different realm where you can take off the eclipse glasses and look in the sky and see a sky that you've never seen before. And if you miss the total eclipse on April 8th, there won't be another one in the United States outside of Alaska until 2044. So that's a long wait.
Yeah, it is. Now, what happens when it is cloudy or if it's rainy? Does it ruin it?
Well, it's certainly not the experience you want. I'm lucky in that I've seen 8 total solar eclipses and I've never been completely clouded out. Now, there was one total eclipse I went to in the Faroe Islands, way up in the North Atlantic near the Arctic Circle, a notoriously cloudy place, where on eclipse day, the weather was starting to clear. And during the total eclipse, I got to see the eclipse itself, the solar corona, for all of 3 seconds. And I counted myself lucky. So I've never been completely clouded out. But I understand from people who do witness it under a complete cloud cover, basically the day goes from gray to dark as night. And then it gets bright again. You'll feel the shadow moving over, but you're not going to get to see all the wonderful things in the heavens that you want to see. So if in terms of choosing a location to go to, the real critical consideration is where will you find clear skies? And so eclipse chasers like me, who plan out their journeys long in advance, are always looking at climate data. Where along the path of totality am I most likely to have clear skies on that day? And then as the day approaches and you can actually look at weather forecasts, that may cause you to change where you're going to view it.
So you're like a storm chaser, but with a longer tail, so to speak.
Precisely, yes, exactly.
Where are you going to see this eclipse?
I will be in Texas. I'm going to Waco, Texas. My whole family is going to be gathered there with me. I live in Colorado, so it's Texas is, in terms of where I might go, Texas isn't all that far. But also for this eclipse, the climate statistics show that Texas is more likely to have clear skies than any place else along the path in the United States. Mexico actually has even better odds. So central Texas, the odds of clear skies are pretty good. You know, hopefully it'll be clear along the entire path.
David Barron is a science writer and the author of American Eclipse. We'll hear more from him later. If you plan to witness the total solar eclipse on April 8th, or even just a partial one, you'll need protective eyeglasses. You've probably heard that, right? But why? Reporter Andrew Stelzer recently talked to somebody very close to him who found out the hard way.
I've known my cousin Max Fisher Cohen for his entire life. I used to babysit him when I was a teenager. But he recently told me a story that not many people in my family have heard.
I had basically perfect vision.
Until Tuesday, May 10th, 1994, the day of an annular solar eclipse. Max was 12 years old.
I was alone. I can't remember why I was alone. I feel like it was the afternoon after school, and I was outside of our house in the driveway.
As you can hear, his memory of the day is a little bit shaky, But Max knew there was an eclipse that afternoon that would be visible from his hometown of Maplewood, New Jersey.
There were warnings, and I remember people talking about that you could, like, hold a piece of printer paper up and watch it through that. But I also remembered people saying something about mirrors.
So Max grabbed a mirror.
It was like a wood frame, like antique-ish mirror that was probably from a garage sale somewhere.
He angled it towards the sun and settled in for the spectacular show.
I'm going to guess, like, that the eclipse went for, like, 5 minutes, maybe, and that I probably looked at it straight for, like, you know, a few of those minutes.
If you're already cringing, we just want to make it clear that, yes, this is a horrible idea. You can't watch an eclipse without safety glasses, even in a mirror. But Max says the experience that day wasn't really painful, and he was mostly filled with wonder.
I didn't have any clue until later that I'd actually hurt my eyes. And then I started seeing purple spots for a couple days. I can remember, like, 3 or 4 days later, like, getting the cold sweats. Like, is this really real? Did I hurt my eyes? No, it can't be.
But of course, Max's eyes were telling him the truth.
Like, a lot of our body parts, when everything's working fine, you don't really realize it or appreciate that there's a problem.
That's Sunir Garg. He's a retina specialist and professor of ophthalmology at Wills Eye Hospital in Philadelphia. Sunir wasn't Max's doctor, but he's seen quite a few people like him, particularly after the 2017 total solar eclipse, when Philly was in the path of totality.
We had seen a few patients who had changes in their central vision called the macula due to looking at the sun.
Solar retinopathy is the medical term for sun damage to the retina, and it can happen anytime someone looks at the sun. It's just that most people don't do so for long periods of time unless there's something special going on.
So on a bright sunny day, our pupils become smaller to allow less light to come into the eyes. And, you know, typical brightness, maybe it's a little bit bad and you squint some to reduce the amount of light coming in. But that's generally all that happens.
But when the eye is exposed to a really bright light for an extended period of time, let's say during a solar eclipse,
the body can only adapt so much. The pupil can only get so small. And the cells in the back of the eye that receive the light, those are the cells in the retina. And when they see light, they have to discharge, send a signal to the brain. Those cells then have to recover, reload, be prepared to send another signal. And that happens very quickly, over and over. But if they're exposed to a very bright light for a long period of time, those cells don't have a chance to recover.
Sunir says there's also just a straight-up burning effect.
The front of the eye, the cornea and the lens, basically are like glasses or magnifying glass lenses where they focus light. And a lot of us have taken magnifying glasses outside on a sunny day and used it to create little spots of light to heat up leaves and maybe get them singeing some. That same thing can happen when we look at a really bright light like the sun. And that light, when it gets focused on our macula, that heat can cause a lot of damage to the macula. And those changes are often permanent, and people can then see them.
Sunir told me my cousin Max's eyes probably got singed back in 1994. The mirror reflected the light, but didn't change the brightness or intensity. In school, Max was used to sitting in the back of the classroom, but after the eclipse, he couldn't read the blackboard and had to move up front.
After like a month or two, I had an optometrist appointment coming up. And on the way in, I said to my mom, you know, don't be upset if I need glasses.
Max could no longer read the same lines on the eye chart as before. His new glasses had a prescription of -1.25, which actually isn't too strong. He wasn't blind. He says more than anything, he was embarrassed about what he had done.
I would say it was more than 10 years before it became something that I would share. 15 years, like my mid-20s.
Everybody makes mistakes, and we all do things that in hindsight we're like, you know, that I was just being a silly goose.
Sunir isn't into shaming patients after the fact, but he says the bad news is, if your eyes are damaged by looking at the sun, there's no way to repair them. There are some vitamins that might slow down the degradation, but your vision impairment can't be reversed. So, in the months leading up to an eclipse, Sunir is all about spreading the word on eye protection.
The key take-home message is regular things like sunglasses are not strong enough. Homemade eye protection is not strong enough. You need to get special glasses that are designed specifically for viewing the sun.
Solar viewing glasses, explains Sunir, block out more than 99% of the light.
And so if I were to put them on in a regular lit room, the room looks black to me. Even if I were to walk outside, I wouldn't be able to see cars on the street. I wouldn't be able to see, even on a bright day, really any of the things around me. It's so dark that the only thing I can see is the very bright sun.
The only time it's safe to take those glasses off is when the sun is completely blocked by the moon. So unless you're in the path of totality, keep them on the entire time. For The Pulse, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
We're talking about the upcoming total solar eclipse on April 8th that will be visible in 13 states. Coming up, for scientists, this is a brief moment where they can gain a lot of insight.
Now's the time to try to capture that data and see what we can do to improve the models.
That's next.
This message comes from Apple Card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase. That's 3% on products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply. Support for NPR and the following message come from the American Cancer Society. Dr. Alpa Patel leads a team that researches cancer risk factors, and she shares how a new study aims to impact an underrepresented community.
My greatest hope for the Voices of Black Women study is that it will help us understand and identify culturally tailored ways to change and really eliminate the unacceptable disparities for future generations of Black women as it relates to cancer.
To learn more, go to voices.cancer.org. This message comes from NPR sponsor Progressive, and it's Name Your Price tool. Say how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show coverage options within your budget. Visit Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
This is Chasing the Eclipse, a special production from The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. On April 8th, a total solar eclipse will be visible in 13 states, stretching from Texas to Maine. And for a total eclipse, this one is actually pretty long, up to 4 minutes in some places. But for scientists who are trying to capture important measurements during this rare opportunity, it's just a brief moment to get everything right. For example, launching weather balloons to study gravity waves in the atmosphere. That will be happening all along the path of totality, and it could lead to better weather forecasts in the future. Alan Yu has more.
In July 2019, scientific software developer Tom Colligan stayed up for 30 hours straight, high in the Andes Mountains in Chile. He was a graduate student and part of a research team launching a weather balloon every hour before, during, and after a total solar eclipse.
I had never pulled an all-nighter in undergrad, and then we pulled this crazy all-nighter, and we're just riding high for like the next day. I remember I didn't even sleep very well afterwards because it was so exciting. We were boiling water on little camp stoves, taking 30-minute naps, and just trying to stay awake to launch these balloons.
These weather balloons carried sensors tens of thousands of meters high in the atmosphere to measure temperature, pressure, and relative humidity. They had to keep filling balloons with 80-pound tanks of helium. The next day, it was time to analyze the data they had collected, and their efforts paid off.
I remember we were whooping because we basically knew that we had detected what we were looking for.
They were looking to measure gravity waves and detect patterns. Gravity waves happen in the atmosphere all the time. It's like when you throw a rock into a pond. the water moves up and down and becomes a wave. The same thing happens when air moves up and down in the atmosphere. It can happen because of a thunderstorm, a volcanic eruption, or even just the wind blowing against the mountain. If you're in a plane flying through a gravity wave, you will feel the turbulence. Jie Gong studies gravity waves at the NASA Goddard Space Flight Center. And when she talks about her work, she often has to first clear up a bit of confusion. She is not studying ripples in space-time.
Like 90% of the time, people, general people, mixing gravity wave with gravitational wave. And they're so excited about it because they thought it's gravitational wave. And you have to tell them, no, it's not. Yeah, it's buoyancy combating the gravity. It's not that fancy. So that's part of the fun part. You know, you need to explain it. But sometimes people get, oh, it's not exciting.
To her, atmospheric gravity waves are exciting enough, and they have a big impact on our daily lives. To put it very simply, gravity waves can move energy from one part of the atmosphere to another. They affect how air moves around in the upper atmosphere, which is important for spacecraft, and they affect daily weather forecasts.
In the weather forecast model, they need to treat gravity waves very carefully. Otherwise, after a few time steps, the gravity waves could be breaking down the entire weather forecast system.
One of NASA's climate models uses code that came directly out of Jie's research. It's something scientists have found difficult to study in the past.
In the early age, when the computer was not that powerful, you basically cannot resolve gravity waves. But you know the impact is there. You have to make it happen in your model.
For years, researchers and weather forecasters have used mostly theoretical understandings of gravity waves in their weather models. One problem with studying gravity waves is that you cannot always know when they will happen and be at the right time and the right place with instruments, except during a total solar eclipse. The moon covers the sun at a predictable time and place. The air suddenly becomes cooler. The temperature change generates force, which leads to a gravity wave. And that is exactly what Tom and his team wanted to detect in 2019, high in the Andes Mountains, by sending balloons into the atmosphere for 30 hours. Physicist Jen Fowler led this team. She's now at the NASA Langley Research Center in Virginia. She says the team was riding high after that experience, where they successfully detected gravity waves with their sensors. They planned another trip to Chile for another solar eclipse in 2020.
For 2020, what we did is we go, okay, we want to confirm what we found.
This time they would have four sites, already a challenge in terms of logistics, and the trip was in December 2020. They had to work with the Chilean government to enter the country with all the pandemic restrictions. They had to get tested for COVID-19 48 hours before their flight. Two teams had to drop out, so they had two remaining. But once in Chile, Jen and her team faced another obstacle they could not avoid. Terrible weather.
I mean, we have pictures where we're launching balloons in downpours of rain, and the sky is overcast.
It was raining because they happened to be in the path of not just an eclipse, but also an atmospheric river, a flowing column of water vapor in the sky. You may remember that term because an atmospheric river led to so much rain in California earlier this year that parts of the state was flooded and hundreds of thousands of people lost power. Needless to say, it is hard to launch weather balloons under such conditions.
It turned out with the atmospheric river, we had a really difficult time getting high enough altitudes because the balloons would just get caught in essentially in the jet stream and just take off and we'd lose contact with them.
The bad weather also created so much noise in their data that their measurements got messed up.
The eclipse-induced waves really became lost in the signal of what was produced by the atmospheric river itself. A lot of people go, oh, you must have had the worst experience with the eclipse because we had overcast skies. But I will say my experience was it doesn't matter what the overcast cloud layer is during an eclipse. A total solar eclipse is incredible.
And it turns out the data they gathered in the pouring rain is still useful. Jen worked with Jie Gong, the gravity wave expert, who is now teaming up with other scientists to separate the eclipse from the atmospheric river in the data. Jen and Jie are going to do more research during the upcoming solar eclipse across the US. There are still some questions about gravity waves that they hope to answer during this eclipse, like how tall are these waves? What path do they take? Jen will be in Fort Drum, New York, in the northern part of the state, doing research with drones. There will be more than 50 teams across the country launching weather balloons to do more studies.
That story was reported by Alan Yu. Scientists have long known how to predict the exact timing and location of total solar eclipses, and they've tried to take advantage of those moments to advance their work. David Barron writes about one such effort in his book, American Eclipse, A Nation's Epic Race to Catch the Shadow of the Moon and Win the Glory of the World. It's about the total solar eclipse that happened in July of 1878.
Back in the late 19th century, astronomers were just starting to unravel the mysteries of the sun. You know, what is this great ball of fire in the sky? What fuels it? And there were certain studies that could be done only during a total solar eclipse.
The 1878 eclipse crossed America's western frontier.
What was then the Wild West. It went from Montana Territory down to Texas, right along the spine of the Rocky Mountains, at a time when the United States was a young country. We had just recently celebrated our centennial. We were 100 years old in 1876. And now in 1878, you know, we were an economic power.
But America was not seen as a true force when it came to science.
This was America's chance to rally and to show the world what we could do in science.
David traces the path of three pioneering scientists who were chasing this eclipse, starting with Thomas Edison. He had become a global celebrity for inventing the phonograph. He had built a reputation as an inventor, but he wanted more.
He wanted to be a scientist. He wanted to show that he was more than just some tinkerer, but he could actually help unravel the mysteries of nature. So he came up with this device called the tezimeter. It was used to detect very small changes in heat. Basically, it was an infrared detector. You could point it at an object and it would detect heat coming off of it. And Thomas Edison was going to use the tezimeter during the total solar eclipse to point it at the solar corona, which today we know is the sun's outer atmosphere. But back then, no one knew what it was, what it was made of. And he was going to see if that beautiful glowing halo gave off not just light, but also heat. And that could provide some clues to what the corona was.
And I think we also have to remind ourselves that it was really daunting to not only make the journey, but to drag all of your equipment and then to get set up, to make sure everything worked. So what were some of the challenges that he encountered?
Well, so Edison, he was in a place called Rawlins, Wyoming, which still exists. It's a small city in Wyoming right along the Transcontinental Railroad, and it was a railroad town. But, you know, it was a small, rustic place in 1878. And he showed up with some other astronomers from the East, and they were looking for a place to set up their equipment. Mm-hmm. They found a local gentleman who let them use his yard. And Edison needed to put his telescope and tezimeter in some sort of structure that would insulate it from other sources of heat. Again, it was used to detect heat and was very sensitive. So he didn't want stray infrared rays coming in from other directions. So he set up his equipment in what was a hen house that he retrofitted into his observatory on that day. But he was able to get his tezimeter to work. It didn't exactly give him the results he had hoped for, but it did detect that there was heat coming off from the corona.
the tessimeter ended up being one of Edison's forgotten inventions. It was too sensitive and didn't really give replicable results.
But remarkably, the very day that he returned from Wyoming to his New Jersey laboratory, he started work on a new invention, and that was the light bulb.
Yeah.
And there were ways in which his Western adventure helped him with that.
Right. The ultimate light bulb moment, I guess.
That's right.
I mean, it's sort of, it's interesting because, you know, you wonder about things and what sparks people's imagination and the way the light kind of like disappears and then comes back on during an eclipse, you know.
Well, it's interesting. There are legends in Wyoming about how the eclipse itself and his time there sparked his idea of the light bulb. And they are mostly legends. There's a story told that after the eclipse, he went fishing with a bamboo fishing pole that broke, and he threw the bamboo fishing pole into the fire, and he saw how the threads of bamboo glowed as they heated up. And in his first light bulb, what he ended up using for the filament that you put the electricity through to heat it up, that it was bamboo that he used. That is true. Mm. But I don't believe it was the bamboo fishing pole in Wyoming that sparked the idea. He ended up looking at thousands of possible substances for his filament before he settled on bamboo. But what is true is he was traveling in the West with some very prominent scientists, and they had conversations about electric light and power, and they kind of encouraged him.
David also profiles Mariah Mitchell, a scientist and astronomer who was teaching at Vassar College. She led an all-female expedition in Denver, Colorado.
This was seen as highly unusual. There's female scientists traveling on their own. But first of all, you know, they didn't have the luxury that the male scientists had of being able to ship their fragile equipment in a special guarded train car that the federal government was using to help these other expeditions get their equipment out west. She was on her own, and she had to pack her telescopes in her luggage. She took out the fragile lenses and carried them with her, but the rest of the telescope setup she had to pack in her luggage. And when she arrived in Denver, her luggage didn't arrive with her. And poor Mariah Mitchell had to frantically search for what happened to her telescope parts in advance of the eclipse.
And then what was the outcome of that expedition? And, you know, did it change hearts and minds? Did it get written up?
It absolutely got written up. And I found, you know, descriptions in the local press of people really saying what an inspiration she and her fellow female scientists were. I mean, Mariah Mitchell wasn't just a scientist. She was a champion for women's rights, for women's suffrage, for women in science. And so people after the eclipse remarked on how she really did help to show what women could do. Now, there were, of course, were also others who were incredibly opposed to this and who saw this as unnatural for women to be professional anything, but certainly professional scientists when they thought a woman's place was in the home. So I don't want to mislead and say that she suddenly changed everything. She didn't. It was the beginning of what was a very long, hard struggle.
And then there was University of Michigan astronomer James Craig Watson.
I have to say he was a pompous ass, really. He was an arrogant fellow. But very smart, obviously, very ambitious. And he had made his name as what was then called a planet hunter. And at that time, asteroids were considered planets because they revolve around the sun, just like the major planets do. And asteroids were considered minor planets. And at that point, James Craig Watson had discovered more asteroids, more planets, than just about anyone else on Earth.
Watson had his mind set on winning glory by finding not just a minor planet, but a major one.
And that planet has a name. It was Vulcan. It was a hypothetical planet that was thought to exist closer to the sun than Mercury. So if you look at solar system charts from that time, you'll see that the solar system begins Vulcan, Mercury, Venus, Earth. Now, as I said, Vulcan was a hypothetical planet. It was thought that it had to exist because Mercury's orbit didn't make sense otherwise. Mercury acted as if there was some mass between it and the sun tugging it along. And so astronomers said, well, there's probably a planet there. In fact, there might be several. They called it Vulcan. No one had ever reliably seen it, but that wasn't really a surprise. If it's that close to the sun, it's never going to be in the sky at night. And you can't see it in the daytime because it's lost in the sun's glare. About the only time you might catch a glimpse of Vulcan would be during a total solar eclipse. And he went to Wyoming in 1878, determined to find the planet Vulcan and to reap the glory that would come with that.
And?
Well, you can probably guess, since you don't see Vulcan on solar system charts today, that Vulcan doesn't exist. However, James Craig Watson thought he found it. And the big headlines were that Vulcan had finally been found. And it took a little while before his discovery was shown to probably, at the time, obviously we know now it was false. At the time, people started to question, did he really see it? And he of course, never backed down.
David Barron is a science writer and the author of American Eclipse, A Nation's Epic Race to Catch the Shadow of the Moon and Win the Glory of the World. His book has been developed into a musical of the same title with a first performance on April 7th, the day before the total solar eclipse at Baylor University in Waco, Texas. Coming up, we'll pay tribute to the real star of the eclipse, the moon.
I mean, if we didn't have the moon, it didn't look to be the same size in the sky as the sun, which is an unbelievable coincidence, then we wouldn't have eclipses.
That's next.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Progressive. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit their website to get a quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, and their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. Then, just choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy. This message comes from NPR sponsor, Bluehost. Try Bluehost Cloud, the hosting plan made for WordPress creators by WordPress experts. With 100% uptime, fast load times, and 24/7 support, your sites can handle high traffic spikes. Visit Bluehost.com. This message comes from NPR sponsor, Lisa. Good sleep should come naturally, and with the new Natural Hybrid mattress, it can. A collaboration between Lisa and West Elm, the Natural Hybrid is expertly crafted from natural latex, natural wool, and certified safe foams to elevate your sleep sanctuary and support a greener tomorrow. Plus, every purchase helps fuel Lisa's work with shelters and those in need. Visit Lisa.com to learn more. That's LEESA.com.
This is Chasing the Eclipse, a special production from The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. For science writer Rebecca Boyle, the solar eclipse is really all about the moon.
The moon is the star of the show. I mean, if we didn't have the moon, it didn't look to be the same size in the sky as the sun, which is an unbelievable coincidence, then we wouldn't have eclipses.
Rebecca has been fascinated with the moon since she was a child, reading bedtime stories where the moon was often a comforting character.
I think it's a constant and it's reliable, but it also, to me, conveys the idea of simultaneous permanence and change, if that makes sense. Like, the moon is always there, but it looks different every night. And there's something kind of comforting about that. Like, you can kind of pay attention to it and notice how it changes. And if a lot of time has passed, you'll realize that by looking at the moon, how different it looks. I think that's just something that gives people a sense of companionship, but also kind of comfort.
Rebecca has a new book about the moon. It's called Our Moon: How Earth's Celestial Companion Transformed the Planet, Guided Evolution, and Made Us Who We Are. Without the moon, the Earth would be a very different place. Maybe the most obvious manifestation of that are tides.
Where the waters in the oceans rise and fall according to the cycles of the moon as it goes around our planet. But it is way more complicated than like the way I think we mostly experience the tide, which is if you go to the beach and now you have to move your towel because the tide's coming in or something. The tide is so much more profound and fundamental than that. And it really shapes everything about our planet, from the length of our day to the tilt of our axis around the sun. So here we're heading toward the spring equinox in the northern hemisphere, which is when the equator will be pointing right at the sun and days and nights are of equal length almost everywhere on Earth. And that is because our axis is tilted at 23.5 degrees. But if we didn't have the moon, our axis would tilt at different angles over millennia, which we know because Mars does this and other planets do too. And this is partly because of just very complicated gravity interactions with other planets and especially Jupiter. But Earth would tip over, essentially, if we didn't have the moon to stabilize us. And that would do really major things to our climate because it would do things like melt the ice caps at our poles. It would inject lots of water or carbon into the atmosphere over millennia. And this is what's happening on Mars. And we think this is one reason why Mars has such a wild and unstable climate. But thankfully, ours is pretty much stable over millennia, thanks to the moon's presence.
So it's this stabilizing force.
It is. It's a stabilizing force in terms of our gravity and the way that the Earth rotates on its axis, the way that it moves around the sun and relates to the other planets. It also has a really profound effect on our biology through its light. And probably through its gravity too, which I didn't know before working on this book. I was kind of blown away by how much the moon's gravity affects our biology. And that includes everything from, you know, animals and the blood in our veins to the leaves of plants. Plants actually respond to the lunar gravity cycle, which is crazy to think about. But it's been demonstrated over and over, even in space. There was a Scottish botanist who devoted a lot of his career to studying the moon's influence on plant life. And before he died in 2017, he was able to get an experiment on the space station where astronauts grew seedlings and measured how their roots and their first leaves responded to lunar gravity. And it was noticeable even in microgravity on the space station that plants are like noticing where the moon is, essentially.
What have we learned about how the moon came about and its origin?
Yeah, this is something I love learning about because it is amazing to me that we don't really know the full story of this event. And we know some of the basic outlines, though. And this comes from the Apollo missions, where we learned that the moon is essentially a part of Earth. And the way that it formed, the way that its rocks are created, tells us a story about the really violent event that must have happened when this took place. So we think something probably the size of Mars smashed into the early Earth when it was pretty freshly baked. And both of these planets were totally obliterated. There wouldn't be a crater from this or any kind of evidence. It was more like they vaporized each other. And in the resulting cloud of rock droplets and vaporized material, two new structures emerged. And that's the now Earth 2.0 and the moon. And we don't know exactly how long it took. We don't know exactly, you know, what the original planet Theia is called, is the mother of the moon in Greek mythology. We don't know exactly what Theia was made of, but we know that we have the moon. It's moving away from us at a certain speed. It's a certain size. Earth is a certain size. So these parameters kind of give us some basic starting points to figure out how this all happened. But we're still not totally sure, actually.
And the moon is moving away from the Earth.
It is, yeah. I'm very sorry to report that the moon is leaving us. It's moving away at roughly the rate at which, like, your fingernails grow. So it's a really small amount over, you know, the course of a year. But over a geologic time, it's adding up to a lot. And that's one reason why it's so far away now. I mean, the moon is really far. I think it's hard to kind of imagine how distant it is from Earth. You could fit like 30 Earths between here and the moon, or almost all of the other planets, if you stack them up, would all fit between here and the moon, which I think is kind of wild. And that's a much greater distance than I kind of thought it was. And over time, it will be even further away, so it will no longer be able to totally eclipse the sun. But that's a long time in the future.
Rebecca Boyle is a journalist. Her new book is Our Moon, How Earth's Celestial Companion Transformed the Planet, Guided Evolution, and Made Us Who We Are. And what she just said about the moon moving away from Earth is all the more reason to enjoy the total solar eclipses while we can, and to follow the advice that science writer David Baron was given years ago, and that he now gives to others.
Before you die, you owe it to yourself to experience a total solar eclipse. In my eyes, in this pose,
in disguises, no one knows. You've been listening to Chasing the Eclipse, a special production from The Pulse at WHYY in Philadelphia, made possible with support from our founding sponsor, the Sutherland Family, and the Commonwealth Fund. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, and Grant Hill. Marcus Biddle is our health equity fellow. Jaden George is our intern. Our engineer is Charlie Kyer. Our producers are Nicole Curry and Lindsay Lazarski. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
This message comes from Jackson. Seek clarity in retirement planning at Jackson.com. Jackson is short for Jackson Financial, Inc., Jackson National Life Insurance Company, Lansing, Michigan, and Jackson National Life Insurance Company of New York, Purchase, New York.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sell without needing to code or design. Just bring your best ideas and Shopify will help you open up shop. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/NPR.
On Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, we have very important people on our show and then ask them about very unimportant things. Here's U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen.
We are also reliably informed that among your enthusiasms, in addition to macroeconomic policy, is mobile games.
There is some truth in that.
There's some truth in that.
Join us for the NPR podcast that considers all the other things. That's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.